Okay, so this is Claire Days interviewing for the South Park A Walk in the Park project, and I'm here on the 19th of February 2015, and I'm here today with Alan Dawes. Alan, can I ask you to say your full name and date of birth?
Alan Philip Dawes, 30th of the 4th, 1947.
Fantastic, thank you. And can I ask where you were born?
I was born in Ilford, I think. But it's somewhere around in Ilford, at any rate, yes.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
And can I ask what your parents did for work?
My mother was originally in service before she married, and my father was what was called a paper executive. He worked in a paper factory organising the way in which the all the paper was made and the way in which it was sorted and, you know, everything that's sort of to do with the administration of it. And he was a pianist as well, which he had more money doing than.
did he play in evenings?
Yes, yes, yes. Lots of places he used to play in. So he found that very interesting. Yeah.
So quite a creative chap.
Yes, yes, yes. He could sort of play anything. You could hum a tune to him and he would extemporize on it and do all sorts of different things on it. It was interesting. Change the key and, you know, he was very, very good. And he did it all from in his head, you know, so. It was great, yeah.
It's a real talent, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Yeah. Unfortunately, I've not got the talent. I've learnt to play the piano, and I still do occasionally, but nothing like that.
Well, at least you've got some of the genes through.
Well, yes. I hope they sort of get passed on to the next generation. Yeah. Yes, fabulous. Yeah.
And did your mother ever talk about her work in the service? Did she ever talk
about it? Oh, yes. Lots of things. Because she was born in Gloucestershire. Down in Herefordshire or the next county over, in Shropshire, that sort of area. And when she was 12, I think it was, her father died. He was a bailiff on a large estate and there were seven children. So as soon as she was 14, and she'd won a place at the first of the girls from that area to actually win a place at Hereford Grammar School. And of course she couldn't go because her father was ill and then late, you know, a couple of years later he died, and she then had to go straight into service. So she went into service about 3 or 4 miles away to a vicar and his wife, and it wasn't very happy, the whole thing there, but she got badly scalded and they wanted just to send her home, no doctor or anything like that, but luckily someone else had called the doctor, so the doctor then came and said she couldn't be sent home, she had to be treated, and then later her elder sister had gone up to London, so she got into service. I think she was about 16 in London and various places, Tower of London, she was there for a while, and ended up at in Hampstead at a big house which was owned by a shipping magnate, and for a lot of the time she was sort of semi-running the house because the other people were away and they organised all sorts of things, and she really enjoyed it, I think, and she, you know, you sort of had, by that time she had servants serving her, even though she was a servant, you know, sort of the hierarchy that went up through, and then met my father at a holiday camp where he was playing in the night about 38, 39, and they got married in 1940, and then she had my brother in 1942, and I was born in 1947. And so that's how it went about. That's where it came from, yeah.
Must have been quite a shock to her sister moving to London.
Yes, well, of course, her older sister had already moved up, so she went into the service at the same place. But she was very self-sufficient, and, you know, she wouldn't let anybody push her around or anything like that. So, yeah.
Good for her.
Yeah.
I suppose you had to mature quite quickly.
Oh, well, yes, you had to at that. Yeah, think of me, you weren't 14, you're off from home and, you know, away, and you'd have one, I think it was one afternoon a week when you could, and she had a bike, so she'd be able to cycle the 4 or 5 miles, whatever it was, back to her home, see them for an hour or two, and then back, because she had to be back to do the things. And I think she was up at 5 to do all the the fireplaces and all that sort of thing, and then she was helping in the scullery, and then, you know, she'd have to do all the washing up, so she would probably be the last one in bed, and then back up again in the morning first thing, you know, very hard.
Can you imagine telling a 14-year-old these days right. They were going to do that?
Yes.
I think you'd get some choice words back, wouldn't you?
You would do, yes. Yeah.
Well, that's fantastic. I mean, I was going to say, I mean, I don't know how you want to structure this. Do you want to talk about your experiences first, or would you like to talk about your father and kind of do a bit more chronologically?
Shall I sort of talk about father's
first?
Yeah,
that'd be great.
Because he lived in Goodmayes as a boy, and he had a friend called Cliff Richards, actually.
not the
Cliff Richards. And they used to go around cycling different places, and his favourite park was this one, because it was lots of different parts to it. And the one thing they particularly liked was the lake, because although Goodmayes Park had a lake, it was pretty barren, there wasn't very much on it. But this one, of course, had the islands, and each island was linked to the others by narrow bridges. And so they used to tear around on their bikes, chasing each other across the bridges and that sort of thing. So they really loved it. And if they had enough money, if they had enough pocket money, they could get the paddle boats out, because there were paddle boats on that at that time, it seems. And one day he managed to fall in. And so his friend's mother had to sort all that out, because he knew if he went home, his mother was rather strict, he would never have been allowed out on his bike ever again. So, you know. But he could remember things like the clock tower just inside the entrance, which had originally been in the centre of Ilford, and that was there until 1944, when the flying bomb, or the, I don't know if it was V1 or a V2, exploded in the park and it went there. And also there was the bandstand, which again is still partly there, but all the superstructure is gone. That again was taken for the war effort, all the metal from that. But he could remember the bands playing there. You know, so there'd be a little, you know, local band or something would be playing in there on a Sunday, and they might go down and see that. So he could remember that. What else was there? Oh, yes, he also remembered, and it was still there, was the small cafe. There was one near where the bowls area is now, but nearer towards the lake. And that was a little cafe, and that was still going when we moved in. So he could remember that, and the bowling club was there by the time he got there, because I think that moved there in about 1918 or something like that. I can't remember the exact date, but it's that sort of time. So in the 1920s, when he would have come, he could remember the bowling club being there. And those were, I think, were his main memories.
Did he ever tell you, sort of describe the clock tower to you, for example?
Not really, no. He just said, oh, it's not there, you know, basically. But not really describe it. Although I've seen pictures of it. There are quite a few pictures about it, either in the middle of Ilford or being where it was. But, that's about all that I can remember from what he'd said.
I've got this amazing image of my head of him and his friend sort of.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. It was funny because I was talking to Ruth, who lives up the road, and she knew about the thing. She must be in her 70s or 80s, so she must have known about the little things going across, you know, the bridges. So I don't know when they finally disappeared, but.
A lady I interviewed on Monday, actually, she was saying that they remember the bridges from when they were young, and she moved here in the late 40s. So, I wonder when they disappeared.
Yeah, well, you could still see bits of them when we came. Concrete bits which had obviously tipped over from where they were and had sort of rails sticking up, but they were sort of more out to the middle, little island at the middle of the one end of the lake, anyway, away from where the water comes in the other end of it. You could still see that, and I think you still can see a little bit of, you know what you're looking for. But I think probably they were, you know, they got probably too old to maintain, and so the park just took them away because they became dangerous. And you know, so. But from the look of it, I think they only had a railing on one side.
They were described to me as very rustic looking.
Yes.
So
yeah,
I can imagine they probably weren't the sturdiest of bridges.
Because of course there were a lot of sort of rustic shelters around the park with ones in it, but they disappeared. 1990s, I think. There'd been some vandalism, and one had been set on fire, and I think they had people sleeping rough in them. But the trouble was that they took them away, and then I think it was about 1999, 2000, they took them away, but they also took all the benches away. So not only was there nowhere for you to go and sit in out of the rain, there was nowhere for you to sit if you were elderly or anything like that. And then gradually they've been replaced and put some new ones in. But the bases are still there. You can still see where the old ones used to be.
be quite interesting to go around and sort of mark them all.
Well, yes, know. Yes, this was one. This was
who
one.
Used to sit here.
Yes, yeah. Yes. So,
so how many years roughly did your father sort of come to the park?
Well, I suppose, he was born in 1915, so I suppose from about, he might have gone there before he was 10, about 9 or 10 or something like that, so that would be, 1924, and he would have probably been 16 or 17, because he was working by then, but I think they still went to, so probably that was sort of mid-20s to 1930, something like that. And I don't think he knew very much about it after that. So that was sort of his time. But he would have probably gone with his parents earlier to the park. Yeah.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Yeah, because he started work when he was 14, but he went into a paper company in London, and that then took him. That's why he became going into the paper business later. Yeah.
So where did you actually grow up then before you...
In Chapel Heath. Okay. He lived in Goodmayes, we lived in Chapel Heath, because it was near to it was Pierre Appleton's then, it became something else after that, but it was one of these 1930s built factory estates, where there were a whole range of factories, and then sort of coming south and west of there was a big estate built of houses, and the workers used to live there and go to the factory, so it was close to, you could walk there and back, you know, for lunch or whatever. And of course that's all gone now, and that's all been built on with houses, but with no employment, you know, so it means you've got to get on a computer route of some sort, but yeah.
It's very different times now.
Very different, yeah. Yes, yeah.
So where did you go to school then?
I went to Chapel Heath Primary and Junior School there, and then I went to Ilford County High School, over at Barkingside, yeah, and then on to university after that.
And did you enjoy your school days?
Yes, I think so. There's a group of us who get together regularly every couple of months. I mean, there's four of us who discuss it and decide how bad it was or how good it was. You know, it's interesting. It's so different to what it was. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And which university did you go to?
I went to Exeter.
Fantastic.
Yeah. Yes, that was nice. I was doing chemistry. It was actually the year when every university, the departments trebled or quadrupled in size in all around the country. So I just got offered 3 E's from 4 different universities. And so I didn't bother to work after that. I just got my E. Well, I got a B and 2 E's, but my A levels. But I liked it because it was near the coast, and the halls of residence, everybody could be in a hall of residence, or there was a few people out in the town, but it was really nice sort of campus to go on to, and it was near the coast, so you could get down to the beach. And it was more to go to university rather than study a subject. But I thoroughly enjoyed it. Yes.
I mean, that's the point of university as well, as life experience.
Well,
as well,
that's
as,
right. Yeah, I mean, it's so different to being around here. So yeah, it was an interesting experience. Yes. Cool. Yeah.
So you qualified in chemistry and then...
Yes, chemistry and physics, actually. I started doing honours chemistry and ended up with a pass degree in chemistry and physics, but that's another story. And then I went on to do a PGCE and then taught locally at Barking Abbey for most of my time. So, yeah.
So what year did you graduate? Sorry?
1968.
68.
Yeah. So I'd have started teaching September 69.
And did you move straight to this area after university, or did you go home to Chadwell Heath first?
I went to Chadwell Heath first and then to Barking, you know, to the teach at Barking Abbey.
Did you get accommodation there as a teacher, or did you...
What do you mean?
At the school, did you get...
No, I mean, I lived at home when I came back, and then after that got married, and we first of all lived down in Ilford, had a flat there for a year, and then we bought this house. And we've been here ever since. It's a nice area, I think. You know, you've got the park there and you've everything. So we've just added onto the top and out that way a little bit. And, you know, it's been fine.
Yeah, it's a beautiful location. Was it really the area that sold this house to you then? Do you
yes,
think?
Yes, it was. We did think about moving at one point, but decided it wasn't worth it. It was easier to build a loft conversion and have the conservatory and just stay where we were. And it was close to where I was teaching, and Lorraine was teaching close by as well, so it was very acceptable.
Convenient.
Mm.
That's the thing, a lot of teachers live a lot further out these days,
yes,
don't they?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, we had a lot of people who lived out either near to South End or out at along the M11 when that opened up, going out from there 20, 30 miles. M11 was stuck, which sometimes it was, and they couldn't get in. You know, it would be afternoon before they arrived, and then they have to start thinking about going back home afterwards, which was, it must be awful trying to do that. Because, of course, house prices have gone up so much. I mean, even when we moved here, I think the price of this sort of house doubled in about 18 months. That was in 1972, 73. There was a big increase in prices. But we were able to buy this. That was good.
That worked out well.
Yes, it did. Yeah.
So let's go on to talk about your memories
right,
of the park,
yes.
Then, if that's okay.
I think my first memory of the park was about 1964, 65. I was a teenager then, and I was playing for St Chad's and Dagenham Tennis Club. In fact, we'd been one that had been set up. I'd been on an LTA course. And we, all of us, decided we would form a club. And that was in St Chad's and Dagenham Park, down in Chapel Heath. And so we were playing matches. And I can remember going to here to play, because there was one of the pairs of tennis courts, it's the one that's now a basketball court, was in fact a tennis club. And I'm not sure what the name of the club was. And at the back of it, they had a small hut where they kept things in, but also it was changing rooms. And we came one Sunday afternoon and played a match there. And then I think we had our refreshments. It may have been in the old Bowls Club pavilion, or it could have been in the cafe in the park, but I can't remember. That's sort of very hazy, that bit. So that's my first memory of the park. And
what were your first impressions at that point?
I thought it was a lovely park. It was very green, and there seemed to be lots and lots of trees and things around, and plants, and at that time it looked quite well organised, you know, and done. It deteriorated later. There used to be the nursery, which they use for doing all the ones around here, was situated in the park, but that was sort of let go back to rack and ruin, and after that they sort of cleared stuff rather than leaving anything else. And one of my colleagues, when she heard that I lived here, where I was teaching, she had been very interested, and she'd lived in the area for quite a while, and she was interested in horticulture, and she said that groups of people sometimes came to the park to have a look at all the trees and shrubs, and there was a large number, the number 65 sticks in my mind, but it may have been more, of trees and large shrubs, and some of them were quite rare in this country, came from New Zealand as well. That again, I mean, obviously it was Dutch elm disease, took some out, and a lot of stuff was cleared. At one point they cleared a lot of the shrubs and the trees from down the sides of the road so the police could see in more, just in case there was something there. So they just cleared all that out. They didn't really replace for a long time. In the last few years, there's been a lot more replanting and redoing things, and it's been better kept. Particularly now that we've got the user group, really, that's the driving force behind it, and in particular, getting all sorts of things from different people to do it. So, but that was my impression. It was a nice park, you know. It wasn't the sort of I knew Goodmayes Park from when I was quite small, but that struck me. It was just empty playing fields and a few trees, and there was the lake, but it didn't really do much. You know, you could go rowing on. I can remember about 1953 or 54, before my grandfather died, going out on the lake, and remember seeing him all muffled up, steering the boat when my father was rowing, and the others of us were at the other end of the boat. But there wasn't very much there. You know, there was a boating lake, but it's, you know, there wasn't much. But this park seemed to be much better sort of planned out and done.
And did your father tell you at that point, when you said you were coming over to South Park to play tennis, was he kind of like, oh, I used to go there when I was...
Well, not really, until we actually started to walk round the park. When we moved in, you know, they come over and we walked round the park, and he said, oh, I remember that. And he'd say sort of things about it, yeah.
lovely. It's quite nice that you both came to love it
individually
as well, I guess.
And of course, when we moved in, it was super, because it was, you know, you just walk across the road and that's it. And I was quite ill in the 1990s, and sometimes I had difficulty moving. Joints were swollen, that sort of thing, and just being able to get across into the park and sort of just getting to the, you know, one or two of the benches there, just sit there for a while, or in the end getting over to the lake and sitting there, and you'd always find people to chat to. They'd come and tell you lots of interesting people, and I found that very useful and very therapeutic, whereas I think if I'd lived sort of further down, I probably wouldn't have done, you know, been too far to walk, whereas I think that did me a lot of good. So yeah, so I've got a lot to be thankful for the park. Yeah.
It makes a lot of difference when you're able just to get out for a little bit, doesn't it?
Oh, it especially does, yes. Yeah. Particularly if your joints ache and you're not feeling very good, and you just get out in the fresh air for a little while, and it's a change, and you get a bit of exercise, and you know, it helps. Yeah.
Fantastic. So what was your next kind of, I suppose moving here would have been your next sort of big memory?
Yes,
of the park.
It was moving here. And we used to go round. I mean, I there were quite a few things that I can remember. Whether they were exactly at that time or not, I'm not sure. I mean, we did have a look at the tennis club, because the sign was still up for it. But the tennis club had stopped. It wasn't there anymore. But we did use the park occasionally to play tennis, because there were a lot of courts there. Lot more than, I mean, there's only two, you know, one area with two courts in now, but there used to be courts by where the adult gym is now, ones where there are, you know, at the moment, the present ones, the ones which are where the basketball court is, and then on the other side of the park bordering South Park Drive, there were two sets of two courts on that side, and it's a fairly level section. You can see where the daffodils were planted. There was a large amount a couple of years ago, or it may have been last year, but that used to be well used, but usually only around the time of Wimbledon. You know, there'd be few people, but not so. There's a lot of tennis courts which weren't all that well used, and of course they were allowed to deteriorate, and as they went, they weren't replaced. Until, again, fairly recently, that those ones which are now the ones there have been renovated and made so they're good, so they're regularly used. People are in there. Quite often you'll go there and you'll see both courts are being used. That's really nice to see. And with the basketball where it is now, again, that was nice courts, but people weren't using it. But now, again, you find people using the basketball courts, and the gym that's there now, of course people are there every day, the adult gym, so you know, that really is a good innovation.
Okay, so shall we just kind of work through
the things?
Fantastic.
We've done, I think, all the first part, haven't we?
I was really intrigued by what you said about the fishing, actually.
The fishing was, there's always been, well, there's, you know, the boating and the fishing were the two things, and I think there was a fishing club, or, you know, it may have been the Essex Club or the Ilford Club or something like that, used it regularly. And in the 1980s and early 90s, there was an old chap there who they used to call the water bailiff, who would come and look after it. And I think he had a number of places where he used to go around, whether he was official or whether he just did it because he had the time and enjoyed fishing or whatever. But he would then go round and see the people. And I think the park keeper also could sell permits, but I'm not absolutely certain about that. And the whoever it was who was running the fishing actually stocked it with carp. So there was a lot of carp in there, but they were fished out quite regularly. And then when that chap died, it sort of, and there'd also been a time when they'd emptied the lake, and so some of the fish obviously had died or been moved out or whatever, and then they restocked it again. And prior to that, there had been a pike in there. I remember being pointed out to me, you know, and you know, they're quite vicious fish, and you wouldn't think it would be in somewhere like that, and they didn't know how it got there. But for 70s and 80s, there was a pike. You know, people would say, oh, I've seen it. So obviously that was there, but most of it was carp. And after the fishing stopped, they continued to breed and they continued to grow. So they were big. I mean, you know, sort of 3/4 of a metre long, big fish. And one day I can remember standing where the water comes into it, there's a little sort of tiny weir where they, and it's a very hot day, standing there looking over and seeing lines and lines of fish. And I managed to count 50 before I gave up, and they were too far out to see it. But they were all lined up. Obviously, the oxygenated water was flowing over their gills, and that's what they needed, you know, and that's why they were there. And then, I'm not sure whether it was, yeah, it must have been about 1998, in June, when the spawning thing is, seeing the lake actually bubbling in three places, near to where the boathouse is, but one right out in the centre, one to one side of the island, one to the other, all at the same time. And it was though the whole of the water in that area was boiling. And you could just make out sometimes the fish would jump as they were doing. And they were all spawning. So there must have been hundreds of them there at that point.
I wonder how they survived, because like you say, I mean, there must have been almost too many for that pond.
Well, yes. Well, it's quite big. And obviously there's a lot of stuff gets washed down into it. So I would think, and I think they probably were good at cleaning out whatever was there, everything that was there. But there must have been a lot of smaller, because you could, at the sort of bit later on in the season, if you stood at the other end where the water comes out, you could actually sometimes see them being washed over. The little tiny fry, you could see them coming in and sparkling in the bits of culvert. You could sometimes see them sparkling as though they were being washed down stream. So there must have been an awful lot there. Mm. A bit later on, I think a lot of the reason why they went was that no one was allowed to fish, or supposedly not fishing, because they found a lot of the swans or the ducks and geese in particular would have either the lead weights or the hooks stuck in their bills. Mm. And they used to call the Egham Swan Sanctuary. And the people would come down. There was someone in the area actually would come down and they'd try and catch them and get out and or whatever, you know, and take them away if necessary. But I can remember going, it must have been 99, 2000, going along out there in the evening and on one end of the park, near to where the water comes in, but on the other side of the lake, finding among this undergrowth, there were lines going out. And when you pulled on them, there was about 20 lines with hooks on those. So whenever I saw them, I used to pull them out, get them and put them in the bins. But other people said the same. So obviously there were people out there just to get the carp and illegally fish. And at night they'd come back probably early hours of the morning, climb over the fence and go and get them. So I think that's why a lot of them, although other people have said it's pollution, because we do get quite a bit of pollution, or we were getting quite a bit of pollution coming in. But I think a large effect was that. So I rarely now see any fish in that lake, when you walk round. Whereas in the past, you used to be able to see them. You'd look down into the water it comes in and you'd see, on the bottom, they'd be swimming around. But no, they're not there now. So that's a bit sad. Yeah, so that was the fish. The pike, yes, we've said about that. The boating lake. The boats were there on and off over quite a long period, until about 1990, something like that. And you'd have someone would obviously get a permit from the council or pay the council, would run boats for perhaps one season, and then they give up. Because it obviously wasn't making any money. And so the boathouse gradually deteriorated and it was left empty. And then, of course, recently, again, the users have managed to get it all renovated and it's now a centre for anybody who's visiting the park. So that's nice to see.
That's what we love about them, isn't it? That they're passionate and get things done.
Yes. So. That's a really nice thing about it.
Do you remember going on the boats much yourself when you first moved here, for example?
No, not really. I think we may have gone on once, but I can't remember actually going. We may have done once or twice. I can't remember what we did on with the children or not. We may have done, but I can't really remember. They all seemed to be quite rickety. Because they were old and you badly repaired and they'd be pulled up on the side and you'd find them, sort of broken bits on them. So I don't know whether, what they were.
But I've heard they were a bit leaky at times.
I think they probably were. Yes, I would fancy it. And the water wasn't all that clean. You know? Yeah, so I don't know. I'll go about the wildlife next, because we sort of mentioned the fish. The birds, it's been interesting, because I just remember Lorraine mentioned something else to me, which I'd forgotten. And that was that when we moved in the 1970s, there were a very large number of coots and tufted ducks, as well as some mallards, which, although we've still got coots, tufted ducks and mallards there, the numbers have gone down. But there were really large numbers of them. I don't remember much in the way of Canada geese at that time. They only seem to appear in the 1980s. And then during the 1980s, I think maybe the 80s or maybe in early 90s, the council had a go at trying to stop them. They put up fencing round on the islands to stop them from getting in. And they employed people to go out in boats and smash the eggs, which unfortunately, I don't think the people knew what they were doing, because eggs of other birds were being smashed as well. And the swans who regularly nested there, their eggs were being smashed. You know, I just think they got whoever was got the contract to do it really didn't know what they were doing. Anything they saw that were eggs, they'd just break them. And I think there was so much complaint about it that in the end they were stopped from doing that. But you can still see little bits of the fences on those little islands. And of course the ducks and the geese can fly, you know, so there weren't any. But I think they must have got EU money or something to do it. So, you know, that was that. We've always had swans on the lake, usually a pair. If you get more than a pair, they will chase them off. And there was one that was there for quite a long while, a male who was very fierce. He was called Tyson, after the boxer. And his thing, well, apart from scaring kids and people, his thing was he would, if they got young in particular, or his mate was on the nest, he would go around killing the geese, particularly if they were young, and he would get them by the scruff of the neck and hold their heads under the water until they drowned. He didn't try to eat them or anything, and then just discard them. So he was quite a nasty character, and he was there for quite a few months. But he was, he was very successful at a number of cygnets that were raised through him.
Maybe the council should have hired him to get rid of the geese.
Well, that's right. Yes. Yeah. Well, I think he did. Because I don't think the geese were breeding very much on that lake. From what I can make out, a lot of the flocks of geese, I mean, you can get 100 come in from one flock and 50 from another and that sort of thing, are actually coming in from other places to the park, because they seem to get fed well there. And I remember one thing seeing, must have been in the 1990s sometime, a lady walking across the park with two bags, and you mustn't carry your, if you've got carrier bags, they know they've got food in. And she took a shortcut across the main playing field, and there were geese grazing the grass. And they all gathered round her. And she screamed, dropped her bags and just ran. And then a day or so later, there were signs put up. Please sign the petition to make the council stop, not allow geese in the park. Well, how you would not allow geese in the park? I do not know, but...
it's not like you can now write them a letter, is
yes,
it?
Yes, that's right. We had all had a good laugh at that. We think it might well have been that particular lady who'd done that. But yes, they were... But they don't seem to be so much like that. They used to be, you know, they chase after you've had bags. They don't seem to be seeing doing as
much.
It's a bit
like a scene from the birds or something. That's right. Terrifying, isn't it?
Yeah. But that was another thing. There was a Egyptian goose who was there for a long time. We used to call we thought it was a him, but it actually was a her. It was called Biggles. And about 2000, another one arrived, and they mated and she nested. But at the same that year, the swans also didn't produce young, and that was, we think, was mainly because in May June time there was a millennium celebration, lots of disturbance of everything around, trees were cut down and all sorts of things, and the marquee went up and everything to disturb it, and then they had the fireworks. And the the wildlife left the nests for a day or two, you know, because they were just frightened off totally by it, by which time the eggs had, you know, gone cold. And I think it was at that year when the egg and chap had to come round and actually collect the cob. That was in August, so long after she should have been. She just sat there and she'd gotten thinner and thinner, and take her off somewhere else because, you know, she wouldn't get off her eggs, you know, which she wasn't able to do. So that was a bit sad. And she didn't have, the Egyptian goose didn't have any young because of that. And then a year or two later, she was seen suddenly one day swimming round and round in circles. I think they probably had a stroke and died a few little while ago. So that was the...
that's really sad.
But we've had them come in occasionally, Egyptian geese. 2 years ago, I remember seeing a pair arrive, but they won't stay for very long.
I know they've got some at Valentine's Park.
Yes,
they?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Do you think maybe they're coming down from there?
They could be, yeah. So, I mean, there are quite a few around, cause of course they're all escaped species, although it seems in Egypt there aren't as many now. They've moved north, you know, as the weather's changed, I think. But I think these were probably from, just like the Canada geese, have got away from places where they've been, you know, kept as novelty items. You know. Muscovy duck. There was a big Muscovy duck, very noisy, which was called Toby when we first moved in. And there had been some other ones. It seems someone told us there were seven. Whether they'd been released there or whether they'd all flown in at one point. And of course, there were no geese. There were only... swans were the only big things on the lake at that time. But in the end, Toby was the only one that was there. And he was there for years, and he would always make his thing. And he sometimes used to follow he didn't worry about the male swan. He'd wander around with them, you know, as though he was a swan. But he was there for a long time, which was unusual, you know, because you wouldn't expect them. And another thing I remembered was, what was thought to be a snow goose arrived, must be about 10, 12 years ago, when it had been snowing, very cold, and there was great excitement. One person in particular was excited about this snow goose on the lake, and it was white, and it did have a red or orange beak and orangey-red legs. But a few weeks later, I went to an exhibition at St Albans, and by the lake there and the river there, there's a mixed flock of grey lag geese, Canada geese, and farmyard geese. You know, obviously they've gone wild. Farmers used the big white ones. Well, the farmyard geese were originally grey lags, which were bred for farmyards. So you've got these all white, and you've got absolutely every colour. And my impression, I think, is it probably wasn't a snow goose. It was probably just one, which was like, it was originally a domestic goose, or it was a grey lag which was bred with a domestic. So it had the colour, but, you know, I'm still not sure whether...
A bit suspicious.
Yes, I was a bit suspicious about it, yes. The other ducks and things, I mean, I've had all the normal ducks and everything else like that, and... I mentioned about the coots and the tufted ducks, and we've had a whole range of those. Herons regularly come on the park, and they have bred on there. And there was, I think, a heronry down somewhere in one of the Dagenham parks, and they used to come in from there. But one of the interesting things I've seen was with the rats, because there's a lot more rats than there used to be, walking around the corner and finding a heron's on the bank with a rat, giving it a good old hammer, and then seeing me flying off into the middle of the lake where there was an old tree stump sticking up, standing there, putting its head under the water with the rat in until the rat perished, and then just tossing it up in the air and swallowing it whole. Then I thought, you know, herons have fish, but no, it seems they're quite happy to get mammals, anything that's good food. So obviously that was something. And I mentioned it to somebody else who a bit knowledgeable, said, yes, they do take mice and rats if they can, although they prefer fish. But yeah. So.
Well, that's incredible, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Natural form of pest control.
That's right, yes. Yeah, so...
Did you ever get moorhens?
Oh, yes, moorhens regularly. They've always been on the... You can still see them now. And with the tufties, you also get American ruddy ducks, which again were brought, because they're pretty, they got blue beaks. And there was a big thing about them trying to eradicate them, because particularly in Spain, they've taken over from the tufted ducks because they can interbreed, and they seem to be more successful at breeding than the native tufted ducks. So what was happening was the tufted ducks were being converted into or a sort of a hybrid between the two. So they did try stopping them, but I don't know, very successful. We still get the ruddy ducks on the lake, which are nice to see, you know, because they're different. So there's been a whole range of different sorts of ducks as well as the common ones. But
have you noticed many changes in like the squirrel populations?
Oh, there was no squirrels. When we first moved in, no squirrels. Not until the 1980s we might see occasionally. But now, of course, we've got large numbers of them, so that was good. The other one about the ducks and the geese and things like that, grebes. We used to get great crested grebes every year. In the 1990s, they used to breed on the lake. So you had a pair who would come and be there for several months and raise young. More recently, you might see occasional one will come in sort of in May, June, but none of the others come in and they don't stay. But the little grebes, which are very, very shy, I've seen them regularly throughout the time we've been here. They stand quietly, particularly in the evenings, and you can sometimes see them pop up. And they're only up for about 10 seconds and they're under again. And you just have to keep watching and you can see them. And particularly in the summer when they've got young, you'll often see them quite close to the bank and be fishing and they'll be taking stuff off. So, yeah, there is a little grebe population there which is breeding. So that's quite nice. And then there are things like, you know, all the normal birds. But one that stuck in my mind was the jay. It was a jay a few years ago. It just followed the squirrels around. The squirrels would bury the nuts. The jay, as soon as the squirrel had missed it off, would watch where it buried it, go over there, dig it up and take the nut. You know? So it obviously learned and it's obviously intelligent. So that was one of the ones. And I remember when we first moved in, there was a large owl. I think it was probably a tawny owl, but I don't know. And that used to, in the winter, you could see it when there's no leaves on the tree. Near the boathouse, there's a little pond, a little island with some tall trees there then. And it used to sit up in the top of there. And sometimes you would see it walking down this road, and I assume the other roads around, where the bold gable ends are. It'd be sitting underneath there. So it'd look as though it was a sort of gargoyle that had been sat there. And you'd look at it and you'd see it move its eyes, or, you know, so you'd realise it was there. And again, that was there for a few years. And I think there have been owls and things in the park, but nothing very much else. And the other one was a kingfisher that I used to see. It's now all that area has been tied about, but on the side of the lake, sort of bordering South Park Drive, there is an area where there's an area in the lake which is quite close to it, you know, an island which is quite close to the bank, and there used to be a lot of trees up beside it. One was a weeping willow. And it's all overgrown. There's a path sort of bit round there now. It was all overgrown. But if you stood there for a little while, you see the flash of blue. And it was a kingfisher. And I regularly saw that. But again, I've not seen a kingfisher, apart from one about 4 or 5 years ago, which was down the other end of the lake, which I'm told probably came from Barking Park, because there are kingfishers in Barking Park. But obviously at that time they were breeding. But that's all been, you know, the bank has eroded and some of the trees have gone in, so it's all open again now, so it's not like it was. So they've, you know, obviously it's not such a protected area for them.
I heard Barking Park stole the swans as well at some point.
Could well have done, yeah. Swans have been interesting because they've, you know, some of them are ringed and some of them aren't. But I remember talking to somebody who, I think it may have been the chap from the Swan Sanctuary, talking about them and saying that the latest one, the female, had actually come from St Albans. So they knew the area where that... They weren't sure where the male wasn't ringed, but that would suddenly come from there. And he said they regularly come from all over the place because he goes around the whole area and knows them. So, yeah, that's quite interesting to, you know, to talk to people like that. Yeah.
It's always nice to hear an expert talking about
it. Yes, I remember we had I think it was last year, it might have been the year before, there was a young swan came into the lake. I think it may have been a little bit dehydrated or something, you know, and it didn't look very good. But the pair of swans and the cygnets all came over and chased it round, and I was over there and a couple of other people, and we managed to get it into the side of the bank and sort of keep it there and keep the others away by throwing things in to keep the other ones away, or pretend that it was food and down there. And the chap from the Swan Sanctuary came down, got in there and got him out and took him off to the Swan Sanctuary to be, and then released somewhere else once it had, you know, recovered fully.
So had it been in an accident or lost?
I think it was just young and inexperienced, and, you know, it saw the lake, probably been flying from somewhere else, may have been driven out from somewhere else, or maybe driven out from different places. And another thing I remember about swans a few years ago, there was a mother swan teaching the cygnets to fly. And she was going up and down with them following on behind, and first one took off and two took off. And then the third one, she started, went back to the other end of the lake and started, and she kept putting her head round, and she kept going down faster and faster and faster, and she wasn't looking where she went slap into the island. And then the other cygnet looked at her. I don't think it took another week or so before he started flying. Thought, I'm not going to do that. I mean, she was all right, but it was a bit of a shock for her. So that was quite a funny incident. Yes. Yeah.
Oh, it must be lovely to see as well.
Yes, yeah. There's so many things when you go over there. You know, having lived there for a long time, there's different things that you see. It's interesting. The mammals, we talked about the squirrels. There were water voles. When we first came, I thought they were rats. But I talked to someone and you could see they were more like sausage shape than that. And they were near the boathouse. And so they'd swim across. And again, round near the boathouse, again, it was all overgrown apart from the boathouse itself, where they had the boats out. But that between there and the island, you could sometimes see them swimming across. And that was in the 1970s, but certainly since then, no sign of them. And I think it's probably because rats are in there. And if you do see them, it'd be the rats that are swimming rather than any water voles that are there. We had an excitement about 16 years ago that the sighting of perhaps a monkjack deer. Someone thought they'd seen it, but there were certainly droppings and there were certainly small hoof print, you know, the